Greetings, this is Reverend Juliet Nightingale, and welcome to this transmission of Toward the Light, Reading Back to the Source. This is a program centered on near-death, out-of-body, and similar spiritually transformative experiences on related topics, including what people should know about the dying process, the many facets of after-death communications, living interdimensionally and being multisensory, intuition and telepathy, and the nature of consciousness. We feature Stella Roster, a special guest who both experiences and researches in the realm of NDEs and related topics. For more information about our organization and the wealth of resources and support that we offer, not the least of which is this radio program, please visit our website, towardthelight.org, and towardthelight.info. This week I'm very pleased to have someone who has written a tremendous book, and interestingly this has been the topic of the past few shows. I'm very excited about this. Anna Maria Hemingway, she is the author of a brilliant book, Practicing Conscious Living and Dying, Stories of the Eternal Continuum of Consciousness. I'm going to repeat this. Stories of the Eternal Continuum of Consciousness, and that is indeed the point. Let us welcome to Toward the Light today, on the 1st of June, Anna Maria Hemingway. Hello, Anna Maria.
Hello, Juliet. Good to be with you.
Oh, it's really good to be with you, too. And I've really been enjoying reading your book, and I'm so excited about the content of what you've written about. And it, tell me if I'm correct, that actually what catapulted you into the writing of this book was your experience with your mum when she transitioned, before, during, and after her transition. Am I right in that assumption?
You are, yes. That was really the catalyst of, you know, actually writing and putting together the book after her transition. So I kind of like to think that that transition actually gave birth to the book, you know, in part of that continuum.
Well, I really was so deeply moved by it, actually, as I was reading your story last night. Because also, I'm just going to be really open with everyone here, is that, you know, I'm not too young either, and I've been dealing with and still am actually dealing with a very serious health crisis, and my own daughter was just up here for past a few days visiting with me, helping me and encouraging me, and, you know, we've just been matter-of-factly having the discussion about, you know, the time when I will transition, and that could be any time, really. Who knows when it's going to be, but, you know, that conversation does come up, and the unconditional love is so paramount, and when I was reading that, you know, about that in your account, it just, you know, it was reminding me of my own daughter and myself, and what a special bond. So that just really warmed my heart, needless to say. And I would like to ask you to share with our listeners a bit about your experience with your mum. And I know you've always had a very special bond with her, and she's a very special entity and still is, thank you very much. So feel free to share with us some of the things that happened that led up to her transitioning, and the telepathic experiences that you had. Also, it looks like your sons had this as well. So please feel free to share with us a bit about this. It's really very special.
Yes, I'd love to. I think, you know, like most people in Western contemporary societies, we really don't have much of a source for how to deal with death and dying when it comes into our own lives. And, you know, I'd had other people close to me die and had gone through all the stages of grief and bereavement that, you know, we do when that happens and comes into our life. But when my mother became seriously sick, I had actually been doing some courses, and the material for that was actually, you know, the practice of conscious dying.
Yes.
And when my mother's health really took a downward spiral, I decided I wanted to be with her in a very different way than perhaps, you know, I'd interacted with other people who had been in a transition process that had come into my life. And so I think one of the things that I found was that, you know, although there is this place of loss and sadness and all the other emotions that we go through, which are really powerful and, you know, very painful, death, like everything else, has another side to it. And if a person is really willing to be consciously there with someone, I think we get to witness this other side. And I think, to me, that side is the manifestation of grace that does appear during that time. So I found with my own mother that, you know, I wanted to be as close to her as I could. Obviously, we can't take another person's journey, but we can accompany them.
Yes.
And during that process, I came across, you know, all the things that perhaps one reads about before, like deathbed visions, mm-hmm. or the idea that, you know, a very psychic act, something very is activated during this process. You know, a dying person is in an altered state of consciousness, and they begin to let go of things that we all worry about in the world. But when we come to that place of facing that final journey, you know, we realize are not important, and just rediscover the things that are, like the unique bonds we have with people, how much we love them, you know, and all of that part of being somebody, being with somebody very consciously, can change that journey, not only for them, but for you. So I actually felt very privileged to be able to be a part of my mother's journey in that way. And I really became very firmly convinced during, you know, the things that would occur that I've written about in the book that were part of my story on that journey, how my own beliefs in a continuum of consciousness following physical death were really strengthened. I did experience, as I say, my mother's deathbed visions. I did have a very striking after-death communication with her. And I think all of these things made me realize at the end of this transition phase that we are very much unprepared, and that what I wanted to do was to sort of compile a source book, if you like, that would give people an opportunity to become curious, get over that, you know, totally fear-based place,
yeah.
and actually discover what is this process of death, how does it help us live our lives more consciously, you know, and explore it a lot further. And so I took everything I could find, really, put it together with 16 very inspirational stories of people who have had death come into their life and have actually had a very transformative, life-changing experience as a result. And, you know, that was and is the purpose of the book, really, to actually try and help people move beyond just being entrenched in fear and perhaps looking at this whole journey of death that we're all going to take at some point or another in a different way.
That's so true, and you're making such a very important point, is that, you know, this whole thing of fear around the process of death and dying, and it so needn't be the case. I remember that you were acknowledging, I believe you read my article called The Dying Process from an Experiencer's Perspective, on, you know, what I was going through, fear just was not a part of it. And in fact, as the more and more that I was letting go of everything involving the physical plane, the more peace and the more knowing. I really need to emphasize the knowing part, because there is a great knowing that comes about when one is you know, moving into a higher frequency of being, and everything is about frequency. All the dimensions are various different frequencies. And so as your mum was going through that process, she was also, you know, her consciousness, her whole being was being broadened. She was able to tap into more of the substance of her being rather than just merely being confined to the, you know, the physical body computer and the physical aspects of the conscious mind and all of that stuff. And how you were able to share in those experiences with her, and indeed that is very, very common, that people will often simultaneously share the deathbed visions with the dying person, also have a very powerful telepathic communion, because of course the dying person can't always verbally speak, but yet there's a powerful telepathic exchange that is very spot on and also doesn't include fear. I remember when I was reading about this, and tell me, please, were you, when your mum was going through that process, is it right that you were also doing hospice work, or was that after the fact? I can't recall.
I actually did hospice work before that. I had done worked in hospice in the UK a few years previously to that, so I had been, you know, in a hospice situation. And once again, you know, people often find it strange when you say that friends or family can walk away from a loved one's transition using words like grace, beauty, peaceful, serene. So I think it's very important to get our minds around the fact that I really love the words that John O'Donohue, the Irish writer who wrote brilliantly about death, was explaining the fact that, you know, a lot of what happens in death is invisible.
Yes.
It's invisible because we aren't sort of attuned to that frequency. I think that, you know, you described that word frequency, and I think that that actually is a very good word to describe what is happening. I think we get very caught up in that human place, perhaps especially if a person has been seriously ill and we see a frail, decaying body and we're shocked, and our images of what's going on is really just, you know, that physical body going through that biological process. But at the same time, there is something else far greater going on. And I think that we're all given the opportunity to be able to tune in to what is actually happening on another level. But in order to do that, we really have to be open and, you know, able to step in and to see that actual transition taking place. And, of course, you know, that's very hard for a lot of people because, as I say, you know, we do get very attached to the idea of the physical body, and, you know, we see a physical body wasting away, and we think that that's all that is taking place, and that it's incredibly sad and, you know, very painful often to witness. And I think one of the points that, you know, that goes with this idea of something invisible going on is the fact that, you know, deathbed visions and after-death communication actually do take place for a great number of people during and after this process. And in a sense, we are really just glimpsing beyond the veil. You know, to me, when I write in the book about near-death experiences, about deathbed visions, about after-death communication, and about just being with a dying person, and I think you know, one of the important things is that these aren't all separate things. They are actually all just part of that penetrating that veil, you know, seeing beyond. And obviously, when one starts to experience these kind of things or does have that kind of experience, it very much changes our perception of what is actually happening at that time. And, you know, that the death, I like the fact that a lot more people use the word transition now.
Yes.
That it's a transition.
Yes.
You know, it's death has that, you know, the idea of some final ending, the body and the brain shut down and that's it. Whereas this idea that people use this term a lot more, actually, really, I think, describes what is taking place. A transition is taking place.
Absolutely, and it's far more accurate and real. And in fact, I avoid the word death like the plague because it's just, it's not really what's going on at all. And, you know, I've got to admit, I'm quite gobsmacked because recently a man here in Vermont was giving me a ride. I don't drive a motor car at all, so a man from this area was giving me a ride to an appointment. You know, we were talking a little bit. He's a friendly chap, but, oh, blimey, he's so ignorant. And, you know, we were talking. He'd actually come into the tail end. This is so strange. I'd given a talk a month ago to a group up here. And, you know, it was, oh, let's see, I think since the beginning of 2001, 2002, somewhere in there. I actually did start giving talks. I've got to, you know, give me thanks to PMH Atwater because she's one who's really, really encouraged me and propelled me on. And she's been a wonderful role model as a fellow experiencer on, you know, helping me to and encouraging me to get out there and also give talks and facilitate different workshops and what have you. So I've actually done a few over the years, not a lot like some people have done, but definitely a number of them. And they've been lovely, they've been brilliant, and including question and answer sessions and all of that stuff. Well, last month when I gave a talk up here, I was blown away that, you know, when I started the question and answer session, not one person asked a question or made a comment. And so then when I closed the talk, not one person said thank you or even gave a little applause, and everybody just filed out in silence. There was only one person who came up to me and thanked me, and he was a fellow near-death experiencer who had had an NDE 40 years ago. And so anyway, the driver was, he came in at the end of my talk to pick up somebody who he was going to give a ride home to. And he said, oh, you scared people. And I thought, well, why would I scare anyone? Because I was talking about the fact that life is eternal, that there is no death. And then, you know, I shared with him, yes, I'm a multiple NDE-er. I've died a number of times, and death just isn't real. We continue to have our consciousness and our selfhood even after we've left the body behind. After all of that, he was still insisting that when your body dies, that's the end of the story, you're gone. And I thought, how can he say this after all of this proof to the contrary? That just absolutely blew me out of the water. So I realized, you know, we've got a lot of work ahead of us still. And to me, of course, what you've been talking about in your book and here and so far, it's just so obvious to me. It's such common sense. And indeed, the majority of what is going on is beyond the lower vibrational frequency of the third dimensional plane. So the telepathic experiences, the DBVs, all of this is huge, and it does happen simultaneously, and it is all deeply interconnected. And I'm so pleased that I've been able to talk with other people, even in the scientific community, like Dr. Peter Finnick and Dr. Mm-hmm. Pim Van Lommel, and recently Dr. Mario Beauregard, and now you know, with this wonderful book, really validating the continuum of consciousness. And I'd like with you to share a bit more about some of the findings that you've come upon in your research. And if you don't mind me asking you, when did your mum transition?
Well, it actually will be 5 years. It is 5 years, actually, because she actually made her transition on the 21st of May. And so that five-year anniversary has just come up. So it kind of always amazes me when I think now how that amount of time could have gone by. But I guess a lot of that time, you know, I did spend researching and putting together the book. And because I have quite a lot of interviews with people, you know, for their own stories, the process was quite a long story. Long one, because, you know, there's a gathering of the stories and then, you know, having the tapes to transcribe and then actually writing it in a story form. So it was quite a lengthy procedure. But, you know, one of the things that really became paramount to me as I was writing the book was that, you know, people ask that question, you know, as you experienced in your talk, perhaps, well, you know, why would you be scaring us or why would you be bringing up this topic? And, you know, for a lot of people, again, we go back to this fear base. If you don't talk about something, it sort of vanishes. And perhaps, you know, every now and then we're shaken out of that complacency because a friend gets very sick or somebody close to us dies or there's some terrible accident or trauma. And then as soon as possible, you know, we want to get back to everyday life and sort of then put it out of our minds again. And I think, you know, really, it has such far-reaching implications, you know, having that kind of viewpoint, because the truth is that everybody carries this fear with them, and it actually goes into the subconscious part of the brain. And of course, you know, once something is there, it manifests in some way. It doesn't just stay forgotten. And the way it manifests is, I think, in people becoming, you know, far more really conscious of their own needs. You know, there's that ego base that if you acquire money, if you have power and position, you know, all of these things are going to make a difference and they're going to fill in that gap and you still won't have to talk about it. And, of course, as we do that as individuals, we become further and further removed from the fact that, you know, we live in a world, we live in a natural world, and we only have to look outside our kitchen or bedroom window or step outside our front door to be reminded that there's a constant reminder of this continuous cycle of birth, death, and rebirth in the natural world all around us every day through the seasons.
Yes.
And that, you know, we are part of that life force. We aren't actually disconnected sitting in our little, you know, concrete or wooden, you know, hideaways and removed from that. But I think, you know, for perhaps, as I, you know, I did quite a lot of research because I am very interested in how myth and sacred scriptures have all been given us, you know, the same message for centuries. But again, it's lost in our psyche. It's become kind of lost. And so, you know, one of the things I became interested in when I was writing the book was, you know, how important it is to reconnect with these ancient messages. We're not giving out a new message here. It's something that's been with us, you know, since the beginning of time. Early agricultural communities, you know, they would look at the sun or the moon or the cycles that they could see a regeneration around them, and they automatically believe that they too must be part of that because they lived in that world. And I think, you know, in the book, in the section that I've done on NDEs, I have the story of Larry Hagman and his NDE-like experiences. And I think, you know, his story is of particular interest in a sense because his story is really illustrating this point. Here is a man who has wealth and power. He was J.R. Ewing, you know, in Dallas. He's had a long career. He's successful. But he had, you know, a place, a a kind of nagging quest that there must be something more, and couldn't find that something more, which actually led to depression within him. So all these outer things do not fill in that gap. And it was through his NDE-like experiences that he actually found the answer to what he was looking for. And, of course, that answer is the same as it is for many NDE survivors, or I would say all of them probably, which is, you know, that love is the most important thing to share. We are interconnected. Losing that fear of death totally transforms the way a person lives their life.
Exactly.
And that there is a continuum of consciousness following physical death. So we have, you know, a large number of people from all around the world now who are experiencing this for themselves. Perhaps for as far as I know, it could be every day now somewhere somebody
yes.
is having an NDE. And, you know, some people like Dr. Kenneth Ring will say, well, you know, perhaps this is an antidote. You know, NDEs serve as an antidote to the fear of death. Perhaps that's
yes.
why they are coming into human consciousness again. I mean, you know, as you know, the NDE is not a new phenomena. Long ago as Plato in the 8th century, there were accounts of NDEs. So, you know, we're not talking about something that just came up in the 1970s and was some new agey thing, which now perhaps people are, you know, beginning to research. We're talking again about something that, when it happened in the 8th century, is almost exactly the same as if it happened today. So there again, you know, we can see in that place that what we're talking is out of eternal or primordial time here, and it's not measured in, you know, what happened in 1969, you know, gave rise to, in the 1970s, perhaps a whole load of research being done on this new phenomenon. It's not a new phenomenon, and of course, neither is after-death communication. All these things have actually been around as long as we have.
Yes, and I'm very grateful that you're making this point, because it's such a valid one, and really the only difference is that we've got a lot more options for really the spread of communications, the spread of information. And it's true that, you know, I think it's probably happening a lot more just because of the fact that, you know, there is the technology, fortunately or unfortunately, to, you know, revive people or what have you, and to bring them back into their physical form, as it were, from the grips of physical death. But you know, I think it's really a true fact that ever since humanity has existed, there have been death experiences. And, you know, you even see hieroglyphs all over the world and images pertaining to this everywhere. And even though this information started circulating a lot in the 70s, and, of course, I had my huge NDE, in the mid-70s, I didn't even find out about it until many years after the fact. I didn't even know about Raymond Moody. I didn't even know about the word near-death experience. I just knew that I had died, and I was in my own little world with it, and then somehow it was like a switch went off in me, and all of a sudden I was just coming out into the open with it. But the interesting thing of this is that whilst I was on the other side, I was told that I had to come back to this plane to share the message that life is eternal. What a piece of work this is, because as you could see, even a week ago, I was dealing with someone who said, oh, you know, he was just so diabolically in denial still about life continuum. And I thought, how can you be conscious and saying, still saying that? Still concluding that, and it's interesting that people are so stuck in their in a closed-minded belief system and fear, and I wonder if they have if they feel a sense of power around that. I don't know. To me, it's very strange because, of course, I'd want to jump on anything that is going to help eliminate fear. And now the only thing that I can think of is that being aware like this does entail responsibility, which some people are not interested in.
I think that's right. It is taking responsibility, and it is because, you know, this person, for example, that you were talking to, you know, has coping strategies in place and does not want them to be removed, just in case.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that is that place that breeds the kind of you know, interaction you had with this person, that really there's almost an aggressive edge to that.
Yes.
Having to, you know, keep that point of view intact and not even allow anything else to crack that, because it would be too scary. And of course, when you talk about this person, you can imagine what kind of a life they've been living themselves, and how probably the way they were dealing with you was the way that they've been dealing with everyone and everything during their entire lives. And, you know, it's very interesting in a way because, you know, the early Greek idea of, you know, life and death, almost, there was this place in certainly in this mythological or way of thinking, you know, through analogy, which was that, you know, people were asleep during their lives, and the only time they woke up was through death.
Yes, thank you very much.
So, you know, I think for a great many people that is the case, you know.
Yes.
That there isn't a moment of waking up into exploring, you know, what's beyond that fear, and that fear really... You know, I think for most people, whether they realize it consciously or not, is this fear of annihilation. You know, me, something's going to happen to me, I won't be there. And that, you know, that kind of shuts the gate to having any further conversation on the subject.
And yet, nothing could be further from the truth. And, you know, I really appreciate the work that my friend David Icke has been doing. He's got a brilliant article that's on my website entitled Fearing for a Lifetime What Doesn't Exist.
Mm-hmm.
And he's referring to death. And then his most recent newsletter is about consciousness and the fact that consciousness does not originate in or from the brain, but actually transmits through the brain. And this is what's so brilliant with what Peter Finnick and Pemban Momo, for example, have also spoken about, and Dr. Mario Beauregard, you know, and these are people in the scientific realm. In fact, they're all working together, actually, in these studies and, you know, about what NDEs experience, and they're actually creating targets that they can you know, report about after they've had their episodes and what have you. And I'm so pleased that people like this, and including Claude Swanson, Dr. Claude Swanson, who are, you know, singing in the scientific community this radiant truth of the fact that consciousness exists outside of the human brain. And interestingly, we've all come up simultaneously with the same analogy regarding the brain as a television or a radio. It is the receiver, not the broadcaster,
mm-hmm.
of consciousness. And so, you know, just because the radio breaks, that doesn't mean the broadcast stops.
Well, no.
And, you know, there again, that's such common sense truth about the fact that consciousness really does continue. And you know, I'm a medium and a clairvoyant, and always have been, and you know, the experiences that you had with your mom were just so beautiful, and I really, really love how she you know, took you a little further in, and she wanted to show you her radiant, beautiful self as the younger lady. Because looking at the decrepit, dying body, that's not who we are. That's not who your mum was. And in fact, when I've spoken with people on the other side, I would even say to them, what do you look like now? And you know, often, and I also pointed this out in the Dying Process article, I remember that people will show themselves to us, you know, maybe in the time in their physical lives when they were thriving, but it's all a projection for the sake of recognition, but their actual form on the other side looks very different. And for me, I remember being like a luminous bubble or orb. I didn't have a humanoid kind of a constitution, but it was just, in fact, when I was talking about it to my daughter and just a couple of days ago, and experiencing such pain and discomfort with my own body, which is really struggling right now, I just got so animated and lit up, and she was commenting on that. She said, "Well, Mum, you completely change when you talk about being a bubble," mm-hmm. because I can still feel it.
Mm-hmm.
There's such a profound clarity and ease and no fear and beautiful peace. So I was seeing that with your mum, and I wanted to ask you, I think you said that, is it true that your son was also, or somebody in your family was also experienced DVDs with your mum? Is that correct?
Well, I think what happened was one of my children actually went back to England for the last 6 months my mother was alive, and he became part of that process too. So sort of things were happening that, you know, were sort of maybe perhaps odd at the time. But he's a very sensitive and had a very close connection with my mother. And again, I think this place just opens up, you know. It's almost like when somebody's had an NDE, for example, because I think perhaps people find it easier to, you know, tune into what that could be. Something very dramatic happens there. And often these people come back and, you know, they have gifts that perhaps they didn't have before. They suddenly find that they're, you know, able to perform healings, for example, or telepathic or clairvoyant, or can see things happening in the future, all those kind of things. And I think what happens in the dying process is that, you know, when we're with somebody who is making that transition, who is on that journey, and we are very actively involved with them, we become part of that higher state of consciousness, I believe, that
yes.
is actually occurring. We get drawn up into that so that we are able to get glimpses of deathbed visions, or certainly be aware that something is going on, even if we can't actually see those apparitions ourselves. And again, you know, you will have perhaps two members of a family who actually understand what deathbed visions may be, why they might occur, and how comforting, you know, this type of visitation is, not just for the person that's making the transition, but the loved one or family. And then you will have, again, you know, perhaps members of the family, well, this is all hallucinations of the, you know, dying brain, you know, it's not really happening, who will not go into that place. So it's a bit like your man again, poor man. I don't know who he was, but you know that we have two opportunities here. I always encourage people, if you are with somebody and this is happening, you know, talk to them, because you will not only learn a lot yourself, but actually, you allow the person, you know, the freedom to tell you what's actually going on for them.
Yes.
You know, that they're not just maybe lying in this bed, or, you know, talking to you and all this outside, again, what we were talking about, you know, decay of the physical body or illness is, you know, creeping through that physical body. But this other place where something else is going on for them as well. And I think that, you know, in a sense, we really almost have to be able to allow ourselves to experience things that perhaps we have never experienced before. You know, for example, after-death communication is far more common than people think. And the final section, you know, of the book is to do with after-death communication because, again, you know, people don't always tell someone when they've had an after-death communication. But
yeah.
When I speak to people, the majority of them, I very rarely found somebody when I've asked the question, well, did something unusual happen? Or did you have any direct, what you feel to be communication? Or was there just something really compelling for you that occurred that made you feel sure that the person was making their presence felt? And, you know, nearly everyone says yes when you give them, again, that freedom to be able to have that kind of conversation. And that doesn't happen very often, but once it starts and you open up that forum, somebody else who's sitting there will draw, oh, well, actually, you know, and they will come forward with their own story. And I think one of the most interesting things for me, again, is, you know, people have all sorts of barriers and denials about things that happen, not just during this transition process, but about, you know, all the things we've been talking about, perhaps psychic phenomena is a good word, or paranormal events. And, again, you know, when I ask people, have you had an experience sometime in your life that you could not rationally explain that has had a really profound, deep effect on you and made you, through that experience, perhaps not say that you particularly believe in this, that, or the other, but it has just expanded your awareness to this idea that there's more going on than perhaps you first previously thought. And I have yet to meet somebody who has said to me, no, I've never had an experience that has made me stop and think there's something else going on in life, you know, that I cannot explain rationally. So all the things that we're talking about here, you know, are, I think, experienced by people most of the time, but they're ignored. You know, that we
yeah.
do get very many subtle signs and messages to make us aware that something else is taking place.
Exactly. And I want to plug a lovely friend here who's been on my show. Her name is Josie Varga, and she is currently working on a book centered entirely on after-death communications. And she's wanting to hear from people. She wants people to submit their ADCs that are verifiable. And interestingly, what got her onto this journey, as it were, is actually through a dream, and it can also happen through dreams. I mean, these things can happen in a myriad of ways, as, you know, Bill and Judy Guggenheim have
mm-hmm.
also pointed out in their book, Hello from Heaven. Josie had a dream about her husband's, I believe it was her husband's boss, and they worked in, you know, in Manhattan, and her husband's boss, you know, his physical body perished during 9/11. And interestingly enough, in the dream, the boss came to Josie and was giving her some important messages with details that nobody could have known about. And she shared it with her husband, and then her husband said, you need to talk with my, you need to, oh, there was a message regarding the boss's wife, something that Boston is okay. What is interesting is that his wife was considering moving to Boston, but she was feeling guilty about the thought because, you know, she and her late husband had gotten a place together and so on. I don't know if it was in New York and New Jersey, but somewhere, you know, it wasn't in New England. So Josie got the message, for example, one of the messages being Boston is all right. And so when she told her husband that, her husband said, you need to get in touch with my boss's wife about that. You know, it'd be very interesting. And so all of this was validated. So this put her into the project of, and she's writing a book now about verifiable ADCs, and of course I contributed a mountain worth of information of experiences that I've had that have all been verifiable, and in fact they're even on my blog. So I'd like to encourage people who are listening to this who have had an after-death communication that can be verified to contact Josie Vaga, and her website is J-O-S-I-E Vaga, that's V as in victory, A-R-G-A, josievaga.com. And I think the more that people can be, you know, just in engaging in these dialogues and not being shy to share their experiences, because they're not crazy. Another thing, too, Anna Maria, is the fact that, you know, you were mentioning, you know, some people still trying to write all this off as hallucinations, but there again, Peter Finnick and Pimpin Luma were explaining very clearly why these cannot be hallucinations, because, and I'm sure you experienced this with your mum, that they can be communicating with someone who's on the other side during their DBVs, and then just as easily and coherently turn and communicate with you with the utmost clarity, and then and keep going back and forth.
Well, exactly. I think, you know, that shows us that consciousness is operating on multi-levels.
Exactly.
And I think one of the things that's really important, because actually, you know, in the book I do cite all that information. Well, not obviously all the information, but I do cite both of those researchers, Peter Fenwick and Dr. Van Lommel, because, you know, they are coming in from what some people, you know, will take as more of an approach that they can understand, which is, you know, they're looking at things from a scientific, ethical point of view, and they are trying to, you know, answer questions. And then, you know, Peter Fenwick himself said that, you know, the medical profession has now really started to embrace the idea of something spiritual occurring during these events. And, of course, that is a major step forward, because people are beginning to realize, whatever area of research they're coming from, that obviously there's a mystery here that we don't fully understand. And perhaps never will, but there are other dimensions, you know, that are coming in to these research projects because of, you know, what happens during this research that actually is pointing to the fact that, you know, there is something else going on here. And I think that that's very encouraging for people, because the truth is that even though we may not discuss death, dying, or bereavement, it is something that we all experience in our lives. And actually, we really all do want to know, well, what might happen to us, you know, when that happens to us, when it's our time, what could we possibly expect? And I think, you know, near-death experience research certainly gives us a glimpse of what could happen to somebody who is determined to be clinically dead. And, you know, like PMH Atwater says, this isn't necessarily just a couple of minutes. It could be as long as an hour, you know.
Or 3 days.
Yes, is resuscitated. So,
I mean, look at George Rodenaya. You know, it was taken out of the morgue even and put on the autopsy table in the operating theater. And he comes back around and blows them away, you know. And, I mean, his body was as dead can be.
Yes.
You know, I've known of a few people who've made it as far as the morgue.
Well, I think the other interesting point for people, you know, which I actually write about in the book as well, is that, you know, people can be having this kind of experience of feeling their consciousness still existing.
Yeah.
And, for example, in Ruben's story, the first story in the book, which is an NDE story, you know, Ruben talks about the fact that one minute he was wondering where he was and what was happening, and the next minute he was in his brother's home and he could hear a sort of conversation going on between his brother and his wife. And, you know, his brother was going fishing and his wife was kind of thinking, you know, she wasn't very happy with the idea and what she was going to be doing while he was gone. And, you know, afterwards, this conversation was totally verified. So
yes,
we see that it's not just a question of leaving the physical body and having this experience, but it's also that consciousness, this consciousness is able to move around and, you know, gain an awareness of something that is later verified to be true. So something is obviously happening.
Absolutely.
And, you know, I think that that is comforting for people, to not only to read these stories, because, you know, near-death experience stories certainly are very validating, not only of life after death, but what it constitutes to lead a good life. And, you know, one of the interesting things, I was talking about Larry Hagman's story that is in the book a bit earlier, and again, you know, Larry was very much like other survivors of such an experience. He spends an awful lot of time now working for charitable institutions and, you know, works in that field of service. And what a lot of these people are coming back and reinforcing this message, you know, a life of service that is not just concerned with the me, but society as a whole, and what constitutes living a good life, you know, being aware of what's going on and trying to make changes. And certainly these people do, you know, make a lot of changes in their, not only in their own lives, but in the lives of other people, you know, through what they have gleaned from this temporary visit to, you know, whatever you want to call it, an afterlife, a continuum of consciousness. But that place of knowing that not only is there validation for life after death or this continuum, but, you know, this second chance perhaps to live a life that is more authentic.
Yes.
And validating, because a lot of people, you know, spend a lot of time depressed about the fact they're not doing what they think they want to do. Life is meaningless. You know, they suffer disappointments and setbacks. I mean, we only have to look at, you know, how many TV programs we have now with psychotherapists giving out advice. And because people are searching, people are not very happy or feeling very fulfilled in a lot of cases. And, you know, when you talk to people who have had a near-death experience, they still have the ups and downs of life to contend with, but they have a very, very different outlook and way of dealing with things. And certainly that connection that I was speaking of earlier to the natural world is very paramount, and quite rightly, because not only do we treat each other very badly often, but we treat our planet and certainly the animal kingdom in a lot of ways in the most criminal ways imaginable. So I think it's very inspiring to hear that we can live life a bit differently, and that these stories certainly help us achieve that goal.
Well, I think so much of, well, indeed, the bottom line of all of this really horrible and dark stuff that is going on, again, the culprit of all of that is fear.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the work that we are doing is really to completely reverse that, because I know in the times that I have experienced physical death, and even other times when I've had spiritually transformative experiences and not even had been near death, the profound love and acceptance and peace and being completely clear of fear is monumental. It is just, you know, the freedom, the key to freedom actually is in all of that. And you know, the point that you're making too is, you know, all of us who have had these experiences and our consciousness, I mean, people when they do detach and go out of their body, they can go to the far reaches of the planet or into spaces. People like PMH and myself, for example, have done. I was one of those more different NDEs who, you know, didn't go through a tunnel, and I wasn't hovering over my body, really, because I think my body was the least interesting or of the least concern to me. I was more interested in other things, so I just went far and away and saw some really profound things. And yet my brain was flatlined. It was, you know, it wasn't really happening. And so for people to be able to do this and then report back, as you were pointing out, accurately, things that were taking place in other regions, you know, that can't be a brain. That can't be the workings of the brain, because the brain is isolated in one specific region, and it can't do that, especially when it isn't even functioning. You mentioned in the book too about Pam Reynolds NDE. What do they call that? A standstill? That the procedure?
She was a really pretty amazing case. Because all the brain, the blood was drained from her brain. I think it's called a standstill.
Right.
And, you know, one of the other things that's really interesting in NDEs, you know, for the survivors is that when the brain has lack of oxygen for more than 1 or 2 minutes, often there is, you know, brain injury, and there are consequences following that. But with NDE survivors, brain activity is often enhanced when
exactly.
they return. So again, we see that, you know, there is something, you know, very important going on besides the stories of the actual experiences themselves. You know, what is happening when these people return? Well, all sorts of incredible things, not only in the way they live their lives, but their complete outlooks. And, you know, I know one lady who actually said, you know, she discovered this singing voice that she'd never had before, and actually now works in one of those organizations that provides music in the transition phase.
Yes.
So people get these incredible gifts that, I mean, maybe she always had this voice, but it had never been able to make its presence felt.
Mm.
So I think, to me, it seems like NDE survivors almost shed a skin, you know, a bit like a snake.
Yes.
They go as they are, and they have, you know, perhaps a life review, and they see their lives and, you know, how everything they've done and thought and been with other people, the way they've been with other people, has actually had a domino effect outwards. It's not just them it affects. And they seem to shed that former personality. So in a sense, there's a sort of psychological rebirth as well.
Yes.
A leaving behind of, you know, all that conditioning and gathering that, you know, I always like to think of it sort of like an impacted tooth or something. You know, the person, the actual essence of that person, you know, from the moment of birth, the personality is so charged with, you know, the way our parents think, the way we're brought up, our schooling, our education, you know, those early traumas we have. And it sort of limits us to our highest potential, I think. And, you know, obviously one of the things that NDE survivors experience is this place of experiencing this wonderful unconditional love and bliss, and then are told that they need to return because their work's not finished. And when they do return, as I said, it's almost as though they have shed this skin of who they thought they were and actually live life as their more authentic, higher selves. And so therefore, they do tend to, you know, work perhaps in hospice, you know, care for the dying, all sorts of different ways of living life that is far more authentic. And I think one of the things that I realized about going through the dying process with my mother, and also as I compiled stories for the book, is that, you know, death really does give us this chance to be our most authentic selves. Again, in a sense, I don't think that it's you have to have an NDE to, you know, to come to understand these profound insights. Simply with being with a dying person can actually almost give you that same kind of feeling that everything that was so important before is stripped away. You know, it's not important. What's important, what's left is what's really important. And that, on, you know, is obviously your love that you share with that person. I think you transcend this place of this mundane, profane world that we tend to become boxed into, and are just expanded into this awareness of not only life being lived outside the self, but what is truly meaningful. You know, what is it that we're actually searching for? So people have a very transformative experience with any of these matters that we've been talking about. And after death communication, for example, you know, can really, again, be very transformative. The idea that when somebody has had an after-death communication, you know, they are very certain, like an NDE survivor, that their experience is real, because perhaps they've been given information that could only come from that person.
Yes.
Perhaps they've been told something that comes true. Perhaps they're helped in a certain way. You know, the person has come through to give them some kind of message that they need to pay attention to. And again, you know, in the book where I write the stories in the final section, which are to do with after-death communication, it's a very similar thing. The people that have had these experiences, again, have a very different outlook on life. They know that, you know, the person that they have lost is still around them in some form. That helps them to overcome their own fear of physical death. So all of these things give us this same information. And I think the other thing, you know, when you've had an after-death communication, again, it stays almost as vivid,
yes,
as an NDE.
Yes.
It's not like a dream, and you have a dream and, you know, for a couple of days it feels very special and then it fades away. These kind of experiences, and I think they often tend to happen in the dreaming state,
yes,
because we lower our resistance,
exactly,
again, and we're open.
Yeah.
You know, they retain this imagery, they retain that message, and they don't just fade away.
And that's, you know, that right there is the distinct difference between you know, these experiences and hallucination, because hallucinations do fade. The memory of them completely fades. Plus the fact is that hallucinations do not impact one in the manner in which an NDE or similar experience does an ADC and DBV. They are all something that really stay with you so clearly, and they continue to affect you for the rest of your duration on this plane, the rest of your sojourn on this plane. Hallucinations, again, cannot do that. And so many people have pointed that out. So, you know, that's why I get so frustrated with the likes of Susan Blackmore, for example. I'm sure being from Britain as I am, you're familiar with her. And
I am.
She makes me livid. She makes me absolutely livid. I don't know how long you've been in America, but there was another person, and I remember reading in the... I think it was the Sunday Mirror. Blimey, it was back in... If my memory serves me correctly, it was dated 19th November 2003. Amanda Cable had this complicated pregnancy, the tubular pregnancy, whatever that's called, I can't remember, but they had to perform a standstill procedure on her as well. And what was interesting is that simultaneously occurred, her 5-year-old daughter was going to school for the first time, and Amanda had no idea what her uniform looked like, what school looked like, anything, because she was already in hospital when her little daughter went to school. Well, during the procedure, she had an NDE, and she actually found herself at the entrance of the school with her little daughter, and her daughter was taking her hand and saying, "Mom, come here, I'm going to show you around." So she showed her mum all around the school, and her mum saw her wearing a sort of cranberry-colored cardigan with a, you know, the skirt was a plaid skirt that had cranberry-colored red and, you know, gray and black colors and all of that stuff. Well, she was able, her husband, after the procedure, brought a picture of her, of their daughter, to hospital. And Amanda just was gobsmacked when she saw it, because she proceeded to tell her husband, "This is exactly what I saw with our daughter." And she started describing in real minute details the experiences that she had, again describing what she wore, describing the school, if she didn't know what the school looked like. All of this stuff, and it turned out to be entirely accurate. And this was somebody who was completely clinically dead for however long the procedure lasted. So that was a big, huge 2-3-page article in the Mirror. I've still got a copy of it, and I just thought, oh, this is brilliant. I was really, really pleased that there's a lot more information circulating about this kind of stuff.
Yes, and I think one of the things is that, you know, people that tend to do research are really researching, but they're trying to get research from their own limited place of setting off. And, you know, to a certain extent, I understand, you know, scientists want to measure things to be true or not true, and they set up certain ways of doing it. Now, again, you know, when we come to Susan Blackmore, of course, we could have all kinds of explanations for things. But I think, you know, the important thing here is to acknowledge the fact we are talking about a mystery. I don't think we will come to the place where science is going to prove to us that what actually occurs during an NDE. I mean, it may, but to me, that's not the important thing. You know, that is part of the mystery. And I think the mystery is very important, because it is something that we're not fully aware of, but we get a glimpse of having had this type of an experience. So I think one of the things, you know, that it may sound a difficult thing to do, but I really think that people need to try to be able to get out of this idea of this linear time.
Yes, absolutely.
We do live our lives in a profane linear time span. When we go out investigating things, we often stay within that space to try and investigate something that takes place out of that time. So, in a sense, you know, that is a difficult task. I had an experience that I write about in the book. You probably read it if you read my story, which is, you know, how I was driving along a country lane one day when my mother had become very seriously ill. And all of a sudden, it was just like a black and white film running in my mind.
Yes.
My mother was Italian, and she had met my father in the war, and they had got married at the end of the war. And my mother was going to come back to England to start a new life with him. And I was thinking about nothing in particular as I was driving, but all of a sudden I just had like this black and white film running through my mind, and I could see my mother in St. Mark's Square on her honeymoon, and I could feel her excitement about this new move to England. And it was such a jolt. I thought, my God, what's happening? What's happening? And that's what I could see. And then suddenly everything reverted back to normal. But I had that feeling at that very second. Well, you know, I've done all this research on time and how the past, the present, the future are one, that time is just time. It's eternal time. Therefore, it always exists. And I thought, my God, I've now actually experienced that for myself. That was the overwhelming feeling I got after this. But when I got home following this incident, my son actually rang from England, and he was with my mother, and she hadn't spoken for a few days, and he said to me, I've just been with Mum, with my mother, you know, at the hospital, and I can't understand her because she's just started talking in Italian. And he turned around thinking that he would leave because she didn't seem to be aware that he was there. And as he put his hand on the doorknob, she suddenly said in a very lucid voice in English, and she hadn't spoken English for several weeks, and just said, pray for me now. And I realized that when he was telling me that, well, I know where she was.
Yes.
Because I
yes.
was there with her.
Yes.
You know, she was in that place in time.
Yes, I was getting the same thing, and as I read that, I thought, oh, blimey, they both experienced the same moment simultaneously, this powerful, joyous period.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, indeed, this is something that, I know that one does experience when, again, one is moving beyond the linear, illusory time frame of the physical moment and experiencing all of these different time frames simultaneously. And I remember the different times that I've been on the other side. And indeed, it's very hard to describe this when people with their mortal minds right now are locked into this time process. It's hard to fathom that you can experience past, present, future, all simultaneously, but you actually do when you're on the other side and not locked in this linear time frame. And again, it's hard to describe it, but there's such a profound sense of freedom,
mm-hmm.
not feeling confined or restricted or what have you. Going to the life review was, well, again, a good example of that sort of thing, because I was seeing all of these things simultaneously, experiencing them simultaneously, and indeed simultaneously. It's almost as if everything was superimposed on the other, and yet I was able to make the distinctions between the different scenes or experiences. It's not as if they became blurry, but when you are in that more omniscient state of consciousness, you're able to get all of this information and not have it be confused, blurred, or lost, or what have you. But again, it's really hard to describe that from the, you know, the context of the physical brain and linear time and all of that kind of thing. But it's so common that you know, people are going to have these experiences simultaneously, and for example, my daughter is doing the same thing with me. My goodness, I'll I'll you know, drift into other dimensions because, again, I've been very, very ill. But not only that, you know, my daughter will see and experience the same things I am. It doesn't matter if I'm grieving or something's going on, or if I'm just popping out of my body for a little while and having these experiences and memories or what have you. Or also seeing something that's going on in this plane, or both of us telepathically picking up on somebody simultaneously. And in fact, a couple of nights ago, we were both picking up on a dear friend of ours back in England, and I said, "Did you see that smirk on his face?" And she looked at me with a big grin and said, "I sure did, Mom." Mm-hmm. And we both saw and experienced the exact same thing simultaneously. Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, it's very interesting when you say that, because, you know, when you talk about, like, a near-death experience or something, for example, people might think, oh, I have to have a near-death experience to experience
no,
that.
No, they don't.
And, yes, and I think that's a very, you know, valid thing to bring to people's attention. Actually, no, you don't. That experience I had that I just described and, you know, I write about in the book is very similar to what one would experience in a life review. It's that moment where you just, you know, you slip out of this dimension of viewing things, and you just get sort of propelled into this place where everything simultaneously happens at once. You know, here you are driving your car along a road, but here you are, you know, interacting with something else that is going on in a whole different dimension of time, and halfway across the world, you know, your child is doing the same thing.
Yes.
And you're all connected.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And another shining example of that is Nancy Clark Besser. She's an NDE, but she's another project person. I love talking about these people because I really want to encourage other experiences to submit their experiences. And Nancy Clark is writing a book about near-death-like experiences.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, she's pointing out that people don't have to be on deathbed to have these experiences. And so what happened to her is that she was giving a eulogy of a friend, and at the same time of giving that eulogy, and she was fine, she was physically totally intact when she was giving that eulogy, she popped out of her body, she went into the light, and she was having this profound experience with the light, having a dialogue, having experiences, and simultaneously giving this eulogy. It was such a powerful experience. So she's inviting people, and she wrote about this in her brilliant book entitled Hear His Voice. And she's just wonderful. You can find her also on my website, Nancy Clark and Josie Varga. If you go down on the index page of towardthelight.org a bit, you can see participants wanted or needed. And she's inviting people who've had near-death-like experiences, or STEs, because usually near-death-like experiences entail a close call where someone actually thinks that one is going to transition and then doesn't. But spiritually transformative experiences, or even DVVs, where people simultaneously share these visions. And so she's inviting people to submit their experiences, because, again, I think the more people can relax and open up and just share their experiences and not be afraid, it's going to help not only themselves but others to realize that this is so natural. And I think an important point about this too is the fact that really when people just start to relax and let go of the stranglehold of fear that is keeping them so locked up in this anguish and fear and servitude and what have you, it's amazing how much the consciousness just by default is going to expand, and people can have these profound and very normal experiences. And in fact, I'm I am, and a number of people are starting to get away from the thoughts of calling this paranormal, because I don't really think it is paranormal. I think it's very natural to have these experiences, and you know, it's done all the time, and that's why I talk about telepathy on the show a lot, because it's very much a natural process of our being, and when we open up, then we can, you know, clearly have these. And I think your son went through this a bit too, did he not? Have you had some telepathic experiences with him? I'm trying to remember, because I read a lot last night as I was studying your experiences with you and your sons and all of that.
Well, we certainly shared that experience that we just discussed, but my son and I actually do have a very psychic connection.
Yes.
You know, that manifests sometimes when we're both worried about some particular thing, perhaps, or just share the same thoughts and then realize, you know, we're thinking the same thing, or I know, you know, what may be happening with him. I remember a few years ago, I was in England and my son was going to the airport and his brother was actually driving him. And I sort of got up in the night. I had a bit of jet lag, and I thought it was that, but I found myself pacing up and down, and I was really kind of worried for about an hour. And I, you know, was kind of thinking, wow, you know, what is this and what's going on? Eventually, the feeling kind of subsided, and I actually fell asleep. But, you know, when my son arrived, he walked in the door and told me, you know, that they'd had an accident on the way to the airport. And that was obviously the very moment that I'd got up. So I think we do experience these things all of the time. They are very natural. And I think the reason they're often called paranormal is really because paranormal is just describing something that happens out of the ordinary. And we have got to this place where we feel these natural occurrences are out of the ordinary, whereas, you know, for people who are familiar with the works of Carl Jung, who wrote a lot about death and dying,
yes,
his dreams and visions, he sort of said, you know, when he was young, if a person died, often a clock would stop at that very moment, or a glass would shatter, or there would be something that would be happening on another level to indicate that there was something or, you know, something else going on. And he also mentioned how this manifested in animals, that at that time people understood that animals were highly intuitive. And certainly, you know, we hear now about this cat that wanders around in the hospice, and, you know, that animals know what's going on to a degree that is higher than our sensitivity. But as Jung mentioned, you know, and he was talking in the 1930s here, he felt that that place had become so stripped of its luminosity that it didn't appear any longer in human consciousness. And, you know, here we are, 50 or so years later from there, and what he was saying is very, very much true. You know, we in the area of even, you know, thinking about death, we tend to view death as the ultimate failure.
Yeah.
You know, when the doctor can't save us, or science can't whiz up some new thing, and the inevitable is not staved off any longer, you know, it's a failure. I mean, there are some cases of doctors in some places that are only paid on results.
Yes.
So we have come so far removed from thinking that, you know, this whole process is a natural part of the life cycle, that anything that is showing us reconnection to the place where perhaps, you know, in human consciousness, maybe 100 years or so even, death was a whole different thing. You know, we had larger families, elder people lived with the family, they were nursed at home, there were rituals and grief ceremonies. The Victorians would wear an armband to signify mourning. Everything was, you know, noticed and was part of this everyday life. Of course, all that's vanished now. You know, we often have somebody just sent off to the hospital in a sterile environment in which people don't really want to visit or keep their visits to, you know, as short a time as possible and want to rush back out to their world where everything seems safe and you know, not part of that situation. We often have ceremonies now, very quick ceremonies in the crematorium where one person's family is queuing up as another is coming out, you know, a nameless minister that doesn't know the person. Yeah. So we've stripped everything as far as we can to this place where often, you know, it's very easy to hide because we make it like that. And, you know, this approach really doesn't do us service at all, not in the way we live our own lives and certainly the way we treat each other because it's, you know, I think you mentioned earlier, it's almost this place of alienation.
Yes, and taboo. I want to share something that David Icke wrote because it's just so spot on and it's exactly about what we're discussing right now. He says, the greatest fear that most people have is fear of the unknown, and the most fundamental unknown is death. How sad it is that lives are blighted by fear of something that doesn't exist. As the Chinese philosopher Chang Tzu put it, the birth of a man is the birth of his sorrow. The longer he lives, the more stupid he becomes. Because his anxiety to avoid unavoidable death becomes more and more acute. What bitterness! He lives for what is always out of reach. His thirst for survival in the future makes him incapable of living in the present. Yet there is no death, just a transition from limitation to all possibility. And I really appreciate, Anna Maria, the way that you were, you know, really talking about, I mean, even the very title of your book, Practicing Conscious Living and Dying. And this is such an important thing because I think that once people can start to get their arms around the fact that we are eternal, we do live eternally. And in fact, whilst I was on the other side and doing my big NDEs in the mid-1970s, I was told specifically to share the news that life is eternal. And there's no way that it could be otherwise.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that really is when people say, well, what is practicing conscious living? Practicing conscious living is accepting that dying is part of that particular cycle of life. And, you know, certainly people as far back as Plato were using the near-death experience not only to show, you know, visions of a possible afterlife in accordance with their religious beliefs, but they were using it as an example of how to live life consciously and
yes.
Well. And, you know, when we say, well, how would he have explained that? And again, it was through example. And, you know, the myth of Ur, which is the near-death experience that I actually write about in the book, because I find it very interesting, as I say, that we're not talking about something when we're in our profane time that happened thousands of years ago. We're actually just talking about something that could be today or yesterday, but it is actually telling us the same story and giving us the same message. And, you know, a valuable part of that message is not only overcoming the fear of death, but actually how to live a conscious life and what's really important. And when a person has an NDE, they have no doubt about what is important when they return from that experience. And it is often very different to, you know, their previous viewpoints.
Yes, and the conviction that we come back with to, you know, do this service for others, come what may, to fulfill this this calling or a mission, as it were. It's just so compelling and so powerful, and it's interesting that even as I have been so ill today, gratefully, I'm feeling a little better, not in such agonizing pain, but over the past fortnight, the past 2 weeks, last Sunday and the previous Sunday, I was in such agonizing pain that I didn't even know if I'd be able to do my show, and I said, no, the show must go on for the sake of the love and the truth and the sharing that takes place. If nothing else, if I collapse before and afterwards, I don't care, but I must do this show. And somehow I have managed to still keep doing it and not missing it, because it is that important to me. I mean, this is just how so many of us are driven as a result of going through these experiences. My daughter also, whilst she was up here this past week spending time with me, bless her, she's such a friend. She said, Mum, you've got to still keep pursuing your dream. Don't stop dreaming, Mum.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it doesn't matter, because I honestly have been toggling between wondering, well, is this it? Am I coming to the end of the line? Or do I still have some time on this place? Because there is that, you call it, that space where you don't quite know. It feels so close, and you're not quite certain. And then, you know, other times when you know for certain, all right, I'm going, I'm out of here.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, in spite of all this, and of course I'm not afraid for obvious reasons, I've really never been afraid of transitioning from this plane. What actually scares me more is hanging out on this plane than transitioning. But she was really, you know, still emphasizing the importance of, no matter what, that we have got to continue to pursue our dreams.
Mm-hmm.
And interestingly, you know, what happened when I had my birthday in February, and I've been ill for quite a while, so I've been sort of wrestling and kind of going up and down with all of this, but I was very ill but in very good spirits during my birthday, and yet I kept hearing the voice compelling me to make your wish. What is your wish? What is really your wish? What do you really want? Not what you think you can have. And I kept hesitating because I'm older and I didn't know if I was getting ready to put me clogs or what have you. But the voice kept saying, no, what do you really, really want? So I think this is a very important point, that all of us, no matter what ages we are, what we are dealing with in our lives, we've got to continue to pursue our dream, our vision, what makes us happy, what gives us joy, as we did when we were little children. Oh, I want to be such and such when I grow up. And their eyes are wide and they're enthusiastic and they're excited and they're full of hope and anticipation. We need to still be doing this.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, you know, I think that's incredibly inspirational to hear you speak of your, you know, your own battle that you are overcoming, and that there's this place of transcendence where what is important actually to do is of paramount importance to you. And, you know, again, in the book, I think this point comes out very clearly, that when people do find a purpose and a reason for the life they're living, they overcome all kinds of obstacles, because they have an almost driving force. I know that I certainly felt that very much when I was writing this book. And, you know, there were certainly periods where I kind of thought, you know, I feel exhausted. Do I want to be doing this, typing away? But again, I had this real compulsion to do it. And
yes.
As I say in the book, I felt very much, you know, this was part of my mother's next phase of life.
Yes.
As I was writing this book, you know, the part, what her life was about was me writing this book.
And so she helped you to write the book as well, that she was with you throughout the whole process.
Yes, and one thing I found very interesting was that, you know, my mother really liked jewellery, and she had a number of pieces that she liked, and actually that I really liked, and sometimes, you know, laughingly, she'd say to me, you know, one day this will be yours, and it would kind of laugh, and I'd say, well, you know, I don't want the jewellery that much. But after my mother's death, my father actually did give me, you know, some bracelets and pieces of her jewellery, and I wear them a lot, and I noticed that, you know, I would be typing away sometimes, you know, hours a day, totally engrossed, and suddenly the necklace I was wearing would just drop off my neck, you know, just suddenly land on the computer in front of me, or a bracelet would just come off. And I actually did take a couple of the bracelets, you know, to the jewelers, because I thought, well, I really don't want to lose this. Supposing this happens one day, you know, when I'm out somewhere and I lost it, I'd be kind of heartbroken. And, you know, they looked at the clasps and shut them and opened them and fiddled around and said, you know, there's nothing wrong with them. So I really took that to be a sign, because we'd had that conversation, and it was a, you know, it was kind of like a little joke between us.
Hmm.
Well, when I was saying, you know, when I write in the last section on the book and after death communication, how subtle yet pertinent these signs are, what better way could my mother communicate with me in that way? Because
yeah.
Instantly, you know, I knew that it was a message from her, because it was something that we'd had conversations about, and again, you know, something unexplainable in any other way, really. You know, why would a necklace that has a clasp and whatever just suddenly come undone and drop down? Well, okay, you could say, well, you know, perhaps you didn't do it up properly, and but when that continually happened, you know, it was a sign. And in the end, it used to make me laugh. And I'd say, I'd think, Mom, you know, kind of like, okay, you're there, you know. And it was an encouragement, and it was a sign that she was there. And I think, you know, that, again, a life has many more dimensions to it than we realize. We've been talking about all these, you know, things that can happen, like after-death communications and the near-death experiences and things, and this idea that there's something invisible going on during this transition process that we can also, you know, be party to if we are open to that possibility. But I certainly think it's the same in our life. There are many dimensions to the life that we lead.
Yes.
That we are not aware of in other people, and certainly sometimes not aware of in ourselves. And, you know, whether my mother happened to be conscious, I don't think, in a conscious manner, that there was something that obviously, you know, right from the word go, I think, from when I, you know, was born and was a child, this was would be the culmination of our relationship while she was on this physical plane. And of course, you know, it would have sounded stranger than fiction if somebody had told me that in advance.
Now, I want to ask you a question. Did you happen to notice what was going on at the time that she did unclasped the necklace or bracelet or what have you? And I do see her mum as a very playful, even childlike spirit. She's just so full of fun, and she's animated.
She was, yes. Very vibrant, very Italian, very, you know, warm. And
yes, and nurturing and all of that. Do you remember something specifically that you were doing or writing about when these little experiences would happen? Or do you? Because sometimes I'll notice when I'm doing something and something will happen, I will make note of both things.
I did notice it when I was writing my own story, because obviously I found that quite difficult, and I put all the other material together, and I was very conscious of wanting to make a good job of that last bit. You know, it's like I'd put the rest together, but this was sort of like the culmination. And so I did notice that once or twice then, and I think I noticed it perhaps sometimes when I was becoming a bit discouraged in some way, you know, perhaps one interview hadn't worked out, or, you know, I was tired, or I was transcribing tapes and they seemed to go on forever, you know, things like that. And but I more than noticed the specific, you know, specific moments of what I was doing, I think what I did realize was that they were consistent.
Yeah. So
it was almost like, you know, I'm here for the duration, and I'm just reminding you I'm here, and then I'm reminding you again, you know, this is why you're writing this book. It always felt to me that when that piece of jewelry or whatever would fall off, there was a sort of real message that I got, this is why you're writing that book, and that message was of this mystery, you know, unraveling part of this mystery that I felt that she was with me, you know, in the writing of the book, and wanted the book, she wanted the book to be written, and that, you know, it was sort of what her life to a certain extent, and certainly all of her suffering, because again, you know, it's very difficult when we see somebody we love that is suffering. But I think, you know, suffering again can take us into that, you know, place of higher consciousness, and that, you know, it affects us when we see somebody that we love who is courageous and fighting, and, you know, we become angry or sad that that might be happening at that particular time. But also, we become aware that through someone else's suffering, we become affected. And it may well change, you know, our outlook and the way that we are dealing with things. It's that place of, I think it's the soul speaks through that universal language of suffering. Sometimes takes that much. You know, we need sometimes to be shaken out of our complacency in the kind of life we live. And all of these instances, painful as they may be, certainly do shake us out of our complacency. And, you know, in the middle section of the book, I've actually written stories about people who have been with a dying person and have actually gone on to do the most incredible things afterwards, that they've worked through this grief, and they've really used the experience as almost a phoenix rising from the ashes.
Yeah.
So they, again, are doing the same thing as a near-death experiencer, you know? They are leaving a former life, found something of intrinsic value through going through this process, and as a consequence, you know, are doing incredible things out in the world. So,
well, my daughter's a very good example of that right now. And she did witness me. She was nursing me when I was on my deathbed back in 1989. And, you know, then most recently she's been working with me. And the beautiful communion that's been taking place. And, you know, she struggled with seeing the agony that I've been going through, and then at the same time she would say, oh Mum, you're so brave, you're such a courageous soul, and it's actually, you know, it's serving to really put some joyous fire under her and passion, and, you know, she's really wanting to do a lot to help spread the word about eternal life, and encouraging me to hang in there. And really, it is the love that is being sent to me, you know, so much, especially from the UK right now. And that love alone is feeding me, is keeping me literally going on, you know, reading your experience with your mum, of course, it's reminding me of me and my daughter, and, you know, ever since losing her beloved daddy, oh, goodness me, we're coming upon the anniversary of that in June here, in the first week of June, 23 years, and, you know, it's amazing, again, the telepathy, how we just both get the same things from her daddy simultaneously, whom we both adored, and also during 9/11, quote, she was in Manhattan and I was in Nashville, Tennessee. And, you know, the only way I had to know that she was all right was her telepathically calling out to me, Mom, I'm okay. Mm-hmm. If it hadn't been for that, and if it hadn't been for the fact that I truly trust in the telepathic communion that we share, I would have been a basket case.
Mm.
You know? Mm-hmm. So, again, there's another really paramount example of how important it is to trust in all of this stuff, and you made a very wonderful point a moment ago about, you know, how all of this interdimensional stuff is going on with, you know, people who are alive. It's going on all around us. One needn't be in the dying process or with the dying person to experience this myriad of dimensions. And in fact, there's been a lot of talk and discussion and write-ups about the fact. I think it's even mentioned a lot in the Celestine Prophecy, for example, James Redfield, about how the veil is becoming much, much thinner. And there's going to be a point in time, not too distant future, I really honestly believe that, very close at hand, where people are just going to be able to access all of these dimensions simultaneously. And just be able to pop into them and see into and experience the afterlife, and there's not going to be this veil or this barrier that we are currently experiencing. So I think that, again, as you're pointing out, is people start to open up more, and that also, when NDEs are, you know, those of us who unfortunately were confined to hospitals and being told that we need psychiatric evaluation, which is so damaging, hopefully this is happening less and less. And physicians, that's why I put my article, The Dying Process, on my website and insist mm-hmm. that people need to read that to really know exactly what is going on when one is dying from the vantage point of an actual experiencer, because you know, the medical establishment, and who was it? I think it was Mario. I've been speaking with so many people. Mario Beauregard, and I think it was another physician I was talking to, and I apologize for spacing that out a little bit. And he was actually telling me that the study of death and dying is only one afternoon in all of the years of medical study. Mm-hmm. One afternoon.
Well, oh. I can believe that. I mean, I think, you know, again, one of the reasons I wrote the book, and I say it, is because I hope I've compiled a source book that actually opens up, you know, curiosity to go beyond what I've actually, you know, written about, the text bits I've written and the stories that are in the book, because everything else in life we have some kind of education on. And, of course, this huge, huge activity that we're going to be taking part of in our life is not covered at all.
Yeah.
So it doesn't surprise me really at all. And, you know, like people have said, you know, up until a few years ago, if somebody was seriously ill, nobody would actually tell them.
Yes, I just remember it's a lad in medical school who was talking to me recently, and he's trying to get them actually to hire me to go out there to Arizona and give a talk, because he's in medical school right now, that's right, and he was telling me that they only get a half a day
mm-hmm.
in all of the years of medical study that covers death and dying. I thought, blimey, this is so absurd. And, Yes, I think your book is a brilliant and beautifully written trailer, as it were, to all of this, because it's very, very important information. And again, anything that is going to help people overcome the fear of something that doesn't even exist.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we could have such a better quality of life by really knowing the truth about all this. And sure, it's unnerving when we don't know what's going to happen, but you know, that could be when we're moving house. It can be when we're getting into a new relationship or starting a new vocation or whatever. I mean, there are so many unknowns that can be kind of nerve-wracking. But also when we have the faith in knowing that we really are infinite consciousness and that we really are going to be all right, regardless of what happens to us, you know, everything is going to be all right, and the light is still at the helm of all of this. And I want to mention the title of your book again, Practicing Conscious Living and Dying, Stories of the Eternal Continuum of Consciousness. Now, you've actually got a website, and I believe it is practicingconsciouslivinganddying.com. Is that correct?
It is correct, and
okay.
It gives more information for anyone that would like it on the book. The book is readily available from all the Amazon sites or any good bookstore in the English-speaking world in Europe. So, you know, if anyone would like to get a copy, it's very easy to get one. And, yeah, the website is www.practicingconsciouslivinganddying.com.
And that's very much the American spelling. I noticed that the book is all American, not English, and that was kind of interesting. So you must have been in America and doing this whole project. And also, you, of course, have got your own profile page on my website, towardthelight.org/Anna Maria Hemingway, spelled with one M, and I apologize, I'd been spelling it with two M's all of this time, oh dear, but it's ANNAMARIAHEMINGWAY.html, and of course I've got links to your website on your profile page too, because it's just really remarkable. It's a beautiful book, it's a beautiful read, and so heartwarming. It certainly has moved me, and I resonate with it entirely. I'd like to ask you before we close out our show for this week, goodness me, it's been such a wonderful dialogue with you, my dear. Have you got any special engagements coming up, anything that you would like to share with our listeners for the next couple of minutes, few minutes that we've got left in the show? Anything coming up that you would like to share, or any?
Well, I am actually hoping to plan a series of workshops, but they probably won't be taking place for a few months. But definitely my website will list, you know, any activities that I am planning to do. I actually, you know, have done quite a few radio shows, such as yours, which I've really enjoyed too. And you know, my main motivation, as I say, is actually really to try and, you know, help people expand that awareness. That's what the book is about. So I think the workshops will really be based on that idea of what it means to practice conscious living and dying.
Now, where are you located, Anna Maria? You're somewhere in America.
I am in Ventura County, California, in a small town that is about 35 miles away from Santa Barbara, for anybody who knows the area.
Okay, so you're in, is that Southern California?
It is Southern California,
okay.
Yes.
And so you would be giving workshops in that area, would it be?
Around this area, I mean, I'm hoping you know, as things open up, to really go anywhere, you know, where people are interested in this type of workshop taking place. But this is all in the planning stage right now, so I don't have anything definite. But, you know, things will get listed on my website as they get firmed up.
Well, that's really lovely, and by all means, keep me posted, and I'll be sure to help spread the word, because, of course, we're all in this together, and this is
a
really important process. And I want to thank you so much, Anna Maria, for being with us for this transmission of Toward the Light. You've been listening to Toward the Light, leading back to the source. We've been speaking with Anna Maria Hemingway, author of the brilliant and beautiful book, Practicing Conscious Living and Dying, Stories of the Eternal Continuum of Consciousness. This is Reverend Juliet Nightingale reminding you that it is only with the heart that one can see rightly. What is essential is invisible to the eye. Please remember that only love prevails. Next week we are going to have Robert Schwartz, the author of Courageous Souls, on next week's transmission of Toward the Light. So please tune in next week. That's going to be a brilliant and beautiful show as well. Thank you, all of us, for joining us. Thank you, Anna, for being with us. This has been absolutely lovely. We will speak to all of you next week. Blessings and light. Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, no, I'm on the air. Hi, how you doing? This is Wesley Snipes, and I'm sitting here with my Pleiadian and Andromedan and friends. And, you know, we were just kicking it, talking about a little extraterrestrial kind of a thing. We're having a little party together. Everybody's coming through from the galaxy. But, of course, you got to get the right directions, so we got to have the right vibration. Right vibrations is listening to BBSradio.com. Okay, I'm ready. I'm ready. I'm go. Where's my ticket for the ship, man?
There's something about the way you try to look. It's getting right to me, deeper than it really should. What are you, an angel, or just looking that good? When you take your time.